Chapter 20. The Poverty Point Time Machine. Dear listener, I do not propose to take you on a tour of every mound and earthwork site in the United States, nor even of every mound or earthwork site I've visited personally. But if you were to rent a car in New Orleans and drive the 800 or so miles north through the Mississippi Valley as far as Cincinnati or a little farther, with time on your hands for some significant side trips east and west, you could plan an interesting journey. Despite the wanton destruction during the past 200 years, some outstanding sites have been saved in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Illinois, and Ohio. And there are also significant sites in Florida, Georgia, Texas, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Indiana. Other states have mounds and earthworks too. But in antiquity, the North American mound-building phenomenon was centered on the Mississippi River and on its great Ohio and Missouri tributaries, and this is reflected in the distribution of the surviving sites today. A number of different mound-building cultures have been identified by archaeologists who have assembled them into categories based on period, location, types of pottery, types of tools, arts and crafts, and other criteria. We've already met some of the leading lights in this typology, such as the Adena, roughly 1000 BC to 200 BC, presently thought to have been the builders of Serpent Mound, the Hopewell, roughly 200 BC to AD 500, who were responsible for Newark and Highbank, and the Mississippians, roughly AD 800 to 1600, who built Cahokia. Archaeologists make routine use of all these labels, but also interpolate them with others that filter out of the classroom and into general consciousness, causing confusion all round. Thus, for example, you will not go far in learning about the mound builders without encountering references to the woodland period, which is in turn divided into early woodland, 1000 BC to 200 BC, middle woodland, 200 BC to AD 600 to 800, and late woodland, AD 400 to AD 900 to 1000. Allowing for some oversimplification of a complicated picture, the Adena culture built its mounds and earthworks during the early woodland period. The Hopewell culture built its mounds and earthworks during the middle woodland period. The Coles Creek culture was prominent during the late woodland period. The late woodland period in turn overlaps with the early Mississippian period. But these are no more than artificial constructs that help tidy-minded archaeologists preserve a sense of order and control over otherwise dangerously unruly data. And besides, we must question how much the types of utensils and tools used by a culture actually tell us anything of value. We wouldn't expect to gather crucial information about modern cultures from their knives, forks, hammers, and screwdrivers. So why should we suddenly set different standards when we try to understand the ancient world? Undoubtedly, many Native American cultures, speaking many different languages, were involved in the construction of the mounds. Undoubtedly, their arts and crafts and tools and pottery differed. Undoubtedly, they expressed themselves in many different ways. Yet when it came to their earthworks, for some mysterious reason, they all did the same things, in the same ways, repeatedly reiterating the same memes, linking great geometrical complexes on the ground to events in the sky. It represents a catastrophic loss of memory for our species, something akin to a madman smashing his own brains out, that there was such wholesale destruction of the Native American earthworks during the rapid growth of the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. To give credit where credit is due, it is entirely because of the excellent, dedicated, meticulous surgery of archaeologists that anything has been salvaged from the wreck at all. And as it turns out, quite a lot has been salvaged. In consequence, whether we're viewing the handiwork of the Adena, such as Serpent Mound, or of the Hopewell, such as Newark and Highbank, or of the Mississippians, such as Cahokia, no sentient person can doubt the prodigious scale of this Native American achievement. There can be no doubt either that geometers and astronomers were in every case central to the enterprise, Nor is there doubt about when the enterprise came to an end, around AD 1600, in yet another catastrophic consequence of the European conquest of North America. But when did it begin? Defying expectations. I'm out near the western edge of Poverty Point, a very mysterious archaeological site in northeast Louisiana, climbing the second biggest earthwork mound in North America. Built around 1430 BC, a century before the pharaoh Tutankhamun took the throne in ancient Egypt, it's often referred to as Bird Mount because of a supposed resemblance to a bird with outstretched wings flying east. Slumped and ruined in places, it does have something of that appearance today, particularly when viewed from the air, but an archaeological reconstruction of how the entire mound would have looked in antiquity does not support the bird interpretation. More prosaically, and more usually, therefore, it's known simply as Mound A. It reaches 72 feet in height. Monk's Mound at Cahokia, 500 miles to the north, is taller by 28 feet and also more massive, but 2,500 years younger and the work of a settled agricultural civilization. Mound A, on the other hand, was made by hunter-gatherers, as was the entire Poverty Point complex, where the oldest element of the site, Mound B, has been dated as early as 1740 BC. The sides of Mound A at its base measure 710 feet east to west and 660 feet north to south, as compared to 720 feet east to west and 910 feet north to south for Monk's Mound. Mound A's volume is estimated at 8.4 million cubic feet, a number hard to visualize. But Diana Greenlee, station archaeologist at Poverty Point, offers a good analogy. Take a standard American football field, she suggests, and make it 146 feet tall. It's that much dirt. Some archaeologists still give credence to the notion that Mound A is an enormous bird effigy, since birds are important within the iconography of Native Americans, past and present, of the southeastern United States. But not so long ago, just as was the case with Monk's Mound, the experts felt they didn't need to invoke Native Americans, or indeed any human agency, to explain Mound A. It and Motley Mound, 2 kilometers north of the Poverty Point complex, were judged to be of natural origin, solitary outliers, the only ones for many miles in any direction, of the geological formations found in the bluffs to the east and west of the Mississippi River, islands left by the drainage which cut the present river valley. Their appearance would easily deceive someone who was not somewhat familiar with such deposits. This confident piece of misinformation, put out in 1928 by respected archaeologist Gerard Fouque, was among a number of factors that delayed proper investigation and recognition of Poverty Point. And again, as happened at Monk's Mound, when the amazing structure could no longer be shrugged off as natural, there were still many who sought to deny Native Americans the credit for it, attributing it instead to some imaginary group of prehistoric Caucasian settlers who in the course of time were overrun by savage Native Americans. All archaeologists now agree that the half-dozen mounds and other earthworks at Poverty Point are man-made. All agree likewise that Caucasian settlers, no matter how appealing the idea continues to prove with the general public, were not in any way involved, and that Native Americans made them. Such disputes and debates as did occur on the road to reaching these conclusions were more around the level of sophistication of the site, the amount of manpower thought necessary to build it, and the degree of socioeconomic complexity that would have been required to see it through. We'll not go into detail here, since we've heard already that the mainstream view for much of the 19th and 20th century was that large-scale monumental constructions like Mound A at Poverty Point could only have been made by equally large-scale, centralized, and hierarchical societies that had the administrative means to carry out such achievements and to organize the large, settled population whose labor is required. Hunter-gatherers, the prevailing theory proclaimed, could never have generated sufficient surpluses, nor put the necessary hierarchical organization in place to make such projects viable. Living from hand to mouth, their concerns were entirely focused on survival. Productive agricultural societies, by contrast, were wealthy enough to lift the burden of the daily struggle to survive from the shoulders of talented individuals, thus allowing a class of specialists, architects, surveyors, engineers, astronomers, and others to emerge and to master their skills. It was realized from the first archaeological surveys in the 1950s that Poverty Point was ancient, but it was not initially assumed to be very ancient. Hitherto, the oldest mounds in America north of Mexico were thought to be early woodland, for example, Edina in origin, dating between 1000 BC and 200 BC, although clustered toward the latter end of that period. Two initial carbon-14 dates, explains Professor John L. Gibson of the University of Louisiana, seem to indicate that the Poverty Point mounds were not only contemporary with early woodland, but overlapped the earliest part of the middle woodland Hopewellian mound-building period. In consequence, pushing the mounds back to the time of Poverty Point was not that drastic a conceptual jump. Indeed, despite being older than any other mounds previously encountered by archaeologists in North America, the evidence from Poverty Point was accepted with relative ease. That it was not the subject of the usual catfights and rival claims, Gibson suggests, was in part because of the general assumption of the profession in the 1950s and 1960s that mound building, pottery, agriculture, sedentism, and large populations were an integrated complex. This all-or-nothing association promoted the assumption of an agricultural base for Poverty Point, despite the lack of direct evidence. Nor would direct evidence ever be forthcoming, for as subsequent excavations have proved, Poverty Point was not the work of agriculturalists, but of hunter-gatherers. This was paradigm-busting in its way, but archaeologists do hate a busted paradigm, so some wriggle room was found. Planned large-scale earthworks, commented Science magazine in 1997, were previously considered to be beyond the leadership and organizational skills of seasonally mobile hunter-gatherers. Poverty Point was considered the exception, and its extensive trade was cited as evidence for sophisticated socio-economic organization. The notion that trade, rather than agriculture, fostered a sufficiently complex and prosperous society to get the mounds built proved satisfactory to most archaeologists. The two younger Hopewellian dates turned up in the initial excavations proved to be out of context. No one now disputes that the oldest structures at Poverty Point go back to around 1700 BC, fully 1,500 years earlier than the first Hopewell earthworks, that the site flourished for 600 years, and that it was abandoned and left deserted at around 1100 BC. The world's largest prehistoric solstice marker. There are six mounds at Poverty Point, labeled A, B, C, D, E, and F. Of these, Mound B is the oldest, perhaps as old as 1740 BC, as we've heard. Mound F, where construction began sometime after 1280 BC, is the youngest, and Mound D, also known as Sarah's Mound, was not the work of the Poverty Point culture at all, but was a much later addition by the Coles Creek culture, sometime after AD 700. Thus it is the four mounds, A, B, C, and E, that form the key elevations of old Poverty Point. Mound A looms massively over all of them. Despite its huge presence, however, it is not the definitive feature of the site, and neither are any of the other mounds. That role is reserved for a complex earthwork, consisting of a series of six concentric ridges, originally up to 9 feet high, forming together a gigantic geometrical figure resembling a half octagon, or the letter C, with a diameter of 3/4 mile. When the lengths of all the ridges are added together, they total almost 7 miles. The ridge crests are up to 100 feet wide, as are the ditches between the ridges, but they were much damaged by ploughing in the 19th and 20th centuries, and today vary from a few inches to at the most about 6 feet in height. When archaeology began at Poverty Point in 1952, the ridges were so insignificant that they went unnoticed for about a year. The late William G. Haag, one of the original excavators, gave a candid account of his reaction when he saw them for the first time in aerial photographs, shown to him in 1953 by his colleague James Ford, who didn't initially reveal where the photographs had been taken. You know where that site is? Ford asked. Well, it's got to be in the Ohio River Valley, Hogg replied. No place except that area in the east where you get complex earthquakes like that. Hogg clearly had in mind the geometrical earthquakes of Ohio, such as High Bank and Newark, reviewed in the last chapter. But he was in for a surprise. You've walked all over that site, said Ford. Not I, insisted Hogg. I've never been to that site. But then doubt set in. He looked closer and finally exclaimed, That's Poverty Point. Hogg may have been a little slow in recognizing the ridges, but he was decades ahead of everyone else when he joined forces with astronomer Kenneth Brecher in 1980 to co-author a paper in the Bulletin of the American Astronomical Society titled The Poverty Point Octagon, World's Largest Prehistoric Solstice Marker. Hogg and Brecher supposed the ridges had once formed a complete octagon, but that the eastern half had been washed away. However, the western half is intact and well-defined. It is intersected in four places by broad avenues radiating out from a common center. The west-northwest and west-southwest avenues have astronomical azimuths of approximately 299 degrees and 241 degrees respectively, accurately pointing to the summer and winter solstice sunset directions at the latitude of the site, 32 degrees 37 minutes north. Subsequent research proved Hogg and Brecher wrong in their assumption that the Poverty Point ridges had originally formed an octagonal shape, a matter that anyway has no bearing on their solstice thesis, which depends exclusively on the angles of the avenues in what survives of the figure today. If they're right about this, then it would confirm a much deeper lineage for the astronomical and geometrical memes that we've followed back in time through the Mississippian and Hopewell and Adena earthworks. Master Plan. In the January 1983 issue of American Antiquity, the alignments along the avenues that Hogg and Brecher had proposed were questioned by Robert Purrington, an astronomer at Tulane University. He agreed that in the epoch of Poverty Point, the sun would have set at the solstices at azimuths of 241 degrees and 299 degrees. He disagreed, however, that these were the azimuths of the west-southwest and west-northwest avenues, which he put at 239 degrees and 290 degrees, respectively. He concluded that these avenues very poorly mark the solstices. There are no obvious solar alignments. Hogg and Brecher responded in the same issue that the discrepancy between their azimuths and those of Purrington appeared to arise mainly from the difference in the location of the center of the earthwork. Purrington, they complained, has located the viewing center at least 100 meters to the east-northeast of the center we have found. They repeated their assertion that for the latitude of Poverty Point, the summer and winter solstice sunset azimuths are 241 degrees and 299 degrees respectively, in good agreement with the orientations of the southwest and northwest avenues. Such a solstitial alignment, while not surprising, seems hard to doubt in the Poverty Point earthwork. Purrington continued to sound like he doubted it, yet in a confusing and self-contradictory manner. In 1989, he published a paper in Archaeoastronomy titled Poverty Point Revisited, Further Consideration of Astronomical Alignments. In it, he recalculated the azimuth of the west-southwest avenue from his previous figure of 239 degrees to a revised figure of 240 degrees that he now stated gave an excellent match to the setting of the sun at the winter solstice, 241 degrees. His azimuth for the west-northwest avenue, however, remained the same as before at 290 degrees, thus missing the summer solstice setting azimuth by as much as 9 degrees, and therefore almost certainly not intended to mark this solar standstill. The symmetry of the site then suggests that neither is a solar solstice alignment. As a final equivocation, however, Purrington conceded that a counter-argument would take into account the special importance attached to the winter solstice standstill by the Native American Indians. There the matter rested until 2006, when archaeologists launched a magnetic radiometer survey at Poverty Point. Completed in 2011, the survey revealed the traces of no fewer than 30 great circles of wooden posts that had once stood in the plaza east of the geometric ridges, some built only inches away from the previous ones, as if the posts were erected, removed sometime later, moved a slight distance, then rebuilt. According to archaeologist Diana Greenlee, who was closely involved in all aspects of the investigation, the post holes located were straight-sided and flat-bottomed, nearly 1 meter wide and 2 meters deep, while the circles they formed varied in diameter from 6 meters to 60 meters. Unfortunately, though, as Greenlee concedes, the project was confined almost exclusively to remote sensing. We didn't excavate a complete circle, or even a significant arc of one, so there's a lot we don't know about the circles. We don't know how many different kinds of post circles are represented. We don't know how high the posts were. We don't know if there were walls between the posts. We don't know if they had roofs. We don't know what, if anything, they did inside the circles. We don't know how many post circles were visible in the plaza at any one time. Someday, I hope to excavate a larger area of the plaza circles so we can find answers to these questions. One possibility, surely worthy of further investigation, is that what the survey found were the archaeological fingerprints of a series of wood henges at Poverty Point. Very much like the wood henge at Cahokia, also constantly moved and adjusted as we heard in Chapter 18, they were perhaps used in conjunction with other features to create sight lines that would manifest sky-ground hierophanies at the solstices and equinoxes. At any rate, even without the circles, the case for significant solar alignments at Poverty Point was greatly strengthened when Ohio archaeologist and archaeoastronomer William Romaine, one of the sharpest thinkers in this field, rolled up his sleeves and got involved. His paper on the subject, co-authored with Norman L. Davis and published in Louisiana Archaeology in 2011, used newly acquired LIDAR data and refined archaeoastronomical calculations to conclude that Brecher and Haag were right in their assessment more than 30 years ago, i.e. Poverty Point does incorporate solstice alignments and may indeed be the world's largest solstice marker. The alignments, however, turn out not to be those that Brecher and Haag originally proposed. Instead, with the advantage of the new data, Romaine and Davis were able to identify two locations of special importance in the design of Poverty Point. Referring to these locations as Design Point 1, DP1, and Design Point 2, DP2, they note, line DP1 to Mound B is aligned to the summer solstice sunset. Line DP1 to Mound E is aligned to the winter solstice sunset. Viewed from Mound C, the summer solstice sun will set over Mound B. Viewed from Mound C, the winter solstice sun will appear to set not over but rather into the side of Mound A. The placement of Mound C allowed for a long sight line to Mound A, but also resulted in the location for Mound A in a place that seems not symmetrical with the overall site plan. A line from DP1 through the central plaza of the site marks the azimuth of the equinox sunset along the northern edge of Mound A. According to Davis, an eyewitness to the latter phenomenon, the sun appears to roll down the northern edge of Mound A before sinking into the western horizon. Poverty Point is a center place, Romaine and Davis assert, and also a place of balance, in the sense that, in addition to the sunset alignments, conceptually opposite sunrise alignments are also found. These they detail as follows. Viewed from DP2, the summer solstice sun will rise over Mound C. Viewed from DP2, the winter solstice sun will rise over Mound D. If, in fact, Mound D was constructed more than 2,000 years after the Poverty Point fluorescence, then the implication is that the people of the Coles Creek culture understood, incorporated, and further expanded upon the Poverty Point design for their own purposes. Viewed from DP2, the equinox sun will rise in alignment with DP1. The overall achievement, the seamless integration of site orientation, celestial alignments, bilateral symmetry of design points, internal geometry, and regularities in mensuration, leads Romaine and Davis to conclude that Poverty Point was built according to a preconceived master plan or design template that integrated astronomical alignments, geometric shapes, and local topography. In their view, the question that begs to be answered is why? Why was Poverty Point designed in such a way that it connects geometric earthen forms to celestial bodies and events at such a massive scale? It's an excellent question, but another should be asked first. If there was a preconceived master plan, where did it come from? Continuity. The southernmost of the Poverty Point mounds is Mound E, also known as Ball Court Mound. Just 2.6 kilometers farther south, however, is another mound, once thought to have been part of the Poverty Point complex. Known as Lower Jackson Mound, excavations by archaeologists Joe Saunders and Thurman Allen have established that it is, in fact, extremely ancient, not from the Poverty Point era around 1700 BC at all, but from fully 3,000 years earlier, specifically between 3,955 and 3,655 BC. That Poverty Point builders were aware of ancient mounds is beyond doubt, comments John Clark, professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University. The entire layout of Greater Poverty Point is calibrated to the position of Lower Jackson, a middle archaic mound. All principal measuring grids pass through Lower Jackson, and calculated space appears to have commenced from there. What John L. Gibson of the University of Louisiana makes of the same evidence is that there must have been an enduring, traditional, if not direct, ancestral connection between the old people and later groups. This connection, he argues, is demonstrated by the incorporation of the middle archaic Lower Jackson Mound into the principal earthwork axis at Poverty Point. Actually, Lower Jackson Mound was not merely incorporated. It furnished the alpha datum, the anchor, a vivid case of material or implicit memory. The suggestions made by Clark in 2004 and Gibson in 2006 were followed up in 2011 by William Romaine. The results of his LIDAR survey greatly strengthened the case that Poverty Point was intentionally oriented to true north along the sight line between mounds EAB and the Lower Jackson Mound. The implications of a connection between the Lower Jackson Mound builders and their successors at Poverty Point are intriguing for many reasons. The intrusive Mound D, built by the Coles Creek culture at least 1,800 years after Poverty Point was abandoned and more than 2,000 years after works peaked there, appears to have been deliberately located to create an alignment to the winter solstice sunrise. In William Romaine's view, as we've heard, this suggests that the people of the Coles Creek culture understood, incorporated, and further expanded upon the Poverty Point design. The suggestion, therefore, is that below the radar of archaeology, more than two millennia of continuously transmitted knowledge connected the Coles Creek culture to the Poverty Point culture. Now going much further back in time, Gibson proposes continuity across the earlier 2,000-year gap between the builders of Lower Jackson Mound and Poverty Point. These are long periods of time to maintain any kind of connection, but such a feat is by no means impossible. The Judaic faith, for example, carries down a body of traditions and beliefs that are at least 3,000 years old. Hinduism has roots going back to the Indus Valley civilization more than 5,000 years ago. Both religions also create architecture, the design of which is directly influenced by their beliefs and traditions. There's no reason in principle why the same sort of thing should not have happened in North America. The notion that Lower Jackson Mound and Poverty Point are each manifestations in different eras of a single system of ideas is the only way, other than coincidence, to account for the obviously deliberate axial relationship between the two sites. If the earlier mound had not been significant for the later builders, then they surely would not have used it to anchor the great enterprise on which they were about to embark. But there's a problem. In the cases of Hinduism and Judaism, we have unimpeachable evidence of continuity through sacred texts, through teachings passed from one generation to the next, and through cherished and vibrant traditions. There are no broken links in the chain of transmission. Neither Hinduism nor Judaism have ever abruptly vanished from the face of the earth, left zero traces of their presence for millennia, and then equally abruptly reappeared in full flower. As we'll hear, however, this appears to be exactly what happened in North America.